tremendous what seems like would have been an opportunity by moving out and Eugene Smith moving in.
Right.
The first year when my first child was born, I went into it very naturally, and I didn't know about what was going on. Then, you know, that would have been a real conflict. I enjoyed that very much. And it then in 1959, Harold and I moved into the countryside, and I rented a piano, and I kept working, singing in a nice restaurant. And then I had a second pregnancy, and went to New York, and then that was in 60. And while 55 to 57 was like the best years, you know, two of the best years, of most carefree years of my life, 60 to 64 was the most tense, full of conflict. In other words, motherhood of the first two children worked well for me. I'm not really saying exactly what I want to say. But in 60, when Harold and I both lived in New York, for a while I took both children, and I remember as a musician in Philadelphia, you work later. It was more like 10 to 2 or something like that. So I would get home, come home at night, and I had like a three-year-old or three or a little over, that I had to get off to school, which would be very early in the morning, like 6 or 7, and so that left very few hours for sleeping. And then I had like a year and a half who gave up naps.
Right.
And so this was prolonged to the extent that I started having hallucinations. And then I moved closer to Harold, and we worked with each other and, you know, helped each other out and shared the children's care. So
right.
I guess the greatest tension or conflict between motherhood and developing what you want to do most in life, which I, you know, started at a very early age for me. I've lost my train of thought.
Well, you were talking about the conflict between motherhood and your art,
yeah,
and how that was at its fullest between 60 and 64.
60 and 64. And 60 is when I had our son, when our son was born, and I had that impossible schedule to live up to. And it was also when all the information about the, not information, but the development of the pill was happening.
Right.
And that went on for years, and trial runs and trial runs of IUDs and so forth. And when I read Margaret Sanger's life, I read that there was planned X number of Planned Parenthoods all over the country, but I didn't know that. And it's like it wasn't I didn't learn it in any of the schools, and there was no woman, wiser, older woman, that ever clued me into that. And I just didn't see it in the media. I mean, I don't think it was in the media. Anyway, I had I worked steadily, and so I had another pregnancy, and I gave that child up for adoption also.
What year was that?
That must have been in 61, somewhere around 61, because all these things happened between 60 and 64. And then I had two more pregnancies that ended in abortion, and it was done by a doctor who was an excellent doctor, and he it was before it was legal, so he was doing it to help women. I mean, truly, that was his mission.
Where was he?
In Philadelphia. I can't locate it any better than that. But that's when I learned about the pill. And he said, you may turn into dust after taking this. From later, I learned that it was 10 times as potent as it is today. And so, you know, one could turn into, it could have a very a bad effect on the person taking it. But anyway, it was successful.
Right.
And then a happy story that comes out of that, in 64, I was touring again. And I was touring as a single, which is can be a very lonely experience. And I didn't commingle or socialize with the patrons. They were mostly guests, traveling salesmen and so forth. And are you still there?
Yeah, I'm here.
There was a click. Okay. Anyway, I was coming back on the train from my gig.
Where was the gig?
It was in, not Wilkes-Barre, but Scranton.
Okay.
Scranton. And I also toured upper state New York, and but anyway, this particular one was in Scranton, and every penny I had, all my money was stolen on the train. And so I got back into the station, found a penny, I borrowed a dime from somebody, and called Harold, who lived in New Hope, Pennsylvania. And he said, you know, come on up, of course. We were friends. And so stowed away on the train to come to near New Hope, wherever. And then I had to catch a bus. And I don't know how I did the bus thing because I didn't have any money. I don't know if Harold paid for it when I got off the bus. I don't know, but somehow I went from nothing to the train, to the bus, and while I was on the bus, I sat down, was sitting next to a man, and we started talking, and he said, well, he played piano. And I said, oh, yeah, I do too. And he said, well, come in some night and listen or sit in or whatever at Canal House, which is, I guess, fairly well known. Blossom Dearie had been appearing there before Joe DeRice. And so I went in and I sat in and I was hired on the spot to play downstairs with the bass player.
Right.
And the bass player that played with Joe DeRice upstairs was the person who became my second husband. And so I think that's always been an exciting story.
Yeah.
In my life.
So what year did you and Harold split up?
In 60, or maybe like near the end of 59, because we were living on a farm in the country, and I have no idea why we moved out there, and I don't know if Harold does either, but I still really want to find out why we moved to the country. And so he got a job in Philadelphia being a resident photographer at the University of Pennsylvania, I believe. And they're not knowing that he had not even graduated from high school.
Right.
And so, yeah, that's when we separated, but still stayed in touch with each other. Like I said, we were friends, and we tried to help each other out, but the marriage was over.
So you were living on a farm outside of Philadelphia?
No, when Harold moved to Philadelphia, when our second child was about to be born, I moved to Philadelphia.
Okay.
And so I lived in an apartment with both the children, and that's when the really nightmare were just getting 4 hours of sleep or something a night happened, and then the pregnancies and the abortions, and then the happy ending of the story was when somebody stole my money.
Yeah.
And I had this leap of faith or the tectonic moving into, I just took a totally different path.
Right.
And met Bill Woodson, who was in his summer, he was going to school working on his BA in music, and he was 22 and I was 30, and so we hit it off right away. And
and did you say he was a bass player?
He was a bass player. He's no longer living, yes.
Okay.
He was also black.
Where was he from?
He was from the Newark area. Probably, is it New Orange?
Okay.
And moved to the Newark area. And he had been going to school in Trenton, New Jersey, and he spent the summer trying to earn $1,000 so he could support himself through his last year of college.
So 60 to 64, you were living by yourself in an apartment in Philadelphia with two kids.
With two kids, but at one point, I moved, I couldn't deal with it. I don't know if it was a year or I don't know how long it was, but I moved closer, like within a half a block of him, to a new apartment. And then that worked better in sharing the children. It was still very difficult, and one of the biggest disappointments in my life was I was not able to go to the March on Washington in 63. I think it might have been in November of 63, to hear Martin Luther King.
Right.
But it was also a time when I went to Pep's and Showboat and heard a lot of live music. And one of the first most thrilling showboat was a, not circular, elongated, I don't know if there's a word for that, bar, and the musician was in the center. So I saw Aretha Franklin and just everybody, well, everybody, most of the jazz musicians. I think that was still one of the most exciting periods in jazz, you know, in addition to mid-50s. Up until that time.
Right. So I just want to be clear about the farm. When did you move to that farm out in the country?
What year? In 59.
Okay. And so that's when you decided to split with Harold, because you wanted to move back into the city where you could have more access to gigs?
No. I was working steadily in the country in a restaurant. I was playing singles, doing singles.
Okay.
Harold went to Philadelphia and got the job with the University of Pennsylvania.
Okay.
That's what made the change.
I see.
And then I followed.
Okay. Earlier you told me a really, really poignant story about a particular gig where I think you had had an abortion previously, and there was a really traumatic scene where you were bleeding at the gig.
Yeah, I didn't recall telling you that. Yeah, that to have been associated with when I was in Philadelphia and one of the abortions.
Can you describe that again?
Well, there was a Dr. Zaroff who did the abortion.
How do you spell his name?
At first, I seemed to be okay. And when I went to work one night, I don't know if it was one day later or, one recovers from an abortion fairly quickly. And for whatever reason, I started bleeding. And it was all over the back of my dress, and I had to go to the restroom as often as I could. And I didn't know whether to, you know, acknowledge it and get out of there, but I just kept played to the end of the gig, and I know there was blood all over the piano seats, and I ended up in the hospital, and they threatened me. I can't remember how they threatened me, or they said I might die, or I don't know. It was a threat if I didn't tell them who the doctor was, because it was illegal.
Wow.
And I refused to tell them. And then that's pretty much the...
Did they treat you, or did, what happened when you refused?
Well, they did. They treated me. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's powerful.
Yeah, but I'm wondering, I know other women in music and art and went through other horrific kind of things. And a lot of them had to have been abortions.
Right.
Yeah. And then there's the splitting of when I was, let's see, I guess this probably the summer I met Bill, and then he went back to school, and I went on the road as a single, and I went by bus. I wasn't driving a car. And let's see. No, wrong period. There was the time when I was still with Harold.
Okay.
He knew a person by the name of Dave Dellinger. I don't know if you recognize the name.
What's that name again?
Excuse me?
What's that name again?
Dave Dellinger, or David Dellinger.
Okay.
He was one of the Chicago 8.
Okay.
Or Chicago 7, it started out. And he wasn't, he was a radical for peace. But he wasn't flamboyant like Abby Hoffman and most of the rest. And he was a little bit older. And so I left, or we left, our son in what I can only describe as a commune of about three or four families. David Dellinger was, there was a printing press, and he had, he devoted his, well, let's see, and he put out a not a magazine, but a journal, I guess you'd call it, called Liberation.
Right.
And so my son was there with his whole new surroundings and new family, and I was out on the road being, you know, missing my children terribly, walking down the street and seeing and hearing children saying mommy, and seeing men and women, you know, together holding hands. And so that was one, I'm just saying that it's not all, it's not about me, it's not all about me, it's about, I would like to know what other women have gone, the untold stories. Like there's a song that the Beatles sang, I think it was the Beatles, did Jesus have a baby sister?
Right.
Yeah. And all the unfulfilled, well, one of my favorite, even though it's a cliche, one of my favorite sayings is, oh boy. Just give me a moment.
Yeah, sure.
Mind is a terrible thing to waste.
Oh, yeah.
And that's the way I feel about the world. And I've probably spent as much time in my life in social activism and learning about that, and in the women's movement, being a leader in my in San Antonio, in the women's movement, as I did with music. But music was always a powerful force up until 2007, when I became, for all purposes, bedridden with the CFS. And then since then, I read about Keith Jarrett's experience.
Right.
And learned that he completely lost interest in music for I don't know how long, a year or two. And that's what happened to me. I just, well, I did some reading, but I lost all interest in music.
Right.
And that's just coming back now. Very slowly, and I usually have maybe 2-3 hours mostly that are good, productive moments when I have a clarity of thinking, which is not at its peak right now, but it's not at its lowest either. So often writing works better for me because I, in the description of what I have is MECFS, the E stands for encephalomyelitis,
right,
which is inflammation of the brain, and it has a lot of cognitive and neurological aspects to it.
Right.
So I said answered a lot more than you asked me.
Well, I am still interested in your. I'm very interested in your. I want to ask you about your music. And you mentioned this a little bit in your emails, Nat King Cole. But who, if things had worked out better for your music, what would you have wanted to do with it?
Well, first of all, I felt very good or proud of myself. I figured out scales, but I didn't know what they were called. But somewhere between 8 and 10. So I know I was gifted.
Right.
And then I listened to the radio and was totally absorbed in listening to all the music I could hear, and I heard gospel for the first time, and I sent away for NAACP pamphlets, which my family destroyed. So I wanted to go to New York City for a long time, and I didn't. And I sang with a dance band for a year in high school.
Right.
I wanted to sing and play, but I didn't seem to have much of an opportunity for meeting other musicians that I could hook up with and work with. And on the other side of that is to... At that time, to have been, and I probably wrote this, to be female and to be able to sing and play and look the part, I could work just about any time I wanted to. So that stifled my growth in terms of developing as an ensemble music.
Right.
I don't know what. I just wanted to work in music, no matter. Just the excitement of playing.
Right. Well, so like the gigs you were getting in Philadelphia, like the one that you had, where you had that very traumatic incident. What kind of music were you playing? What sort of instrumentation was in that band? Oh, okay.
Yeah.
What tunes were you playing?
I was playing, starting when I, right after 50, between 55 and 57, when I did the Sheraton Hotel chain, I was playing what I would call obscure standards, like the kind of thing Mabel Mercer would sing, Mad About the Boy, Johnny Mercer tunes, the more obscure tunes from Broadway plays.
And you were playing and singing?
Yes, and Rodgers and Hart, and you know, and all that. And then, one of the great things about the 2 years I was in New York was I got to hear Monk. I mean, I went out, Patty Bone and I were running partners.
Right.
And got to hear Monk at the Five Spot and just about everybody there was, except Bird, who had died a couple months before I got there. So I just wanted to do music and develop myself. But the greatest squelching or what other hindrance. One more thing. Before I, in the 55 to 57 period, Harold and I house sat for somebody on Martha's Vineyard, and I rented the piano, and I was spending like 4 and 5 hours every day getting ready for my tour. And that's when I learned those obscure tunes. And I'm surprised that anybody listened to them, because a lot of them... And then there were things like... somewhere... This Time of Dreams on Me. And, right. You know, all those good standards as well.
Right.
And then there was a period when I went on the road. Oh gosh, this must have been the time that between the year from when my second husband, the bass player, and I met to when we married. And by the way, my marriage with Harold was what you would call a common law marriage.
Okay.
I soloed and I played in all kinds of joints, a whole spectrum, where the pedals wouldn't work or they were playing some kind of noisy games next to me. And one of my jobs was to mingle with to go to the bar and sit there, and so men would come up and buy drinks for me.
Wow.
I mean, part of my job was selling drinks.
Right.
And so I remember that often I would have like 6 glasses of screwdrivers lined up underneath the piano, concealed in back of the piano, because I was never much of a drinker. Like 3/4 of a glass of wine would get me just to a nice place. And
wow, so that's fascinating. The Sheraton Hotel tour, was that mostly up in around New England?
Yes, it was. It was in New England, and I would say it must have been Connecticut and Massachusetts, I guess. And then one time I also toured in Upper New York, and I'm not sure where that, if that was in that period or not. And that was Rochester, and I think it was even Buffalo once. Then I played in Washington, D.C. once, which was a fabulous club, in which people like Peter Lawford and, you know, movie stars, well-known people, came in. And
what was the name of the club?
I don't remember the name of any of the clubs. I was thinking, you know, all during the spirit when we were talking. The only club I can remember is Canal House in New Hope.
Okay.
And that's when I was there, I got to see the Ellington Band. And Judy Garland's daughter, Liza Minnelli, sat in. And one of the big time talk show hosts who has become a millionaire, a billionaire, requested Young and Foolish, that I sing Young and Foolish. So I've worked in really, and then one more thing, when I was in that 55 to 57 period, although it doesn't even sound believable, but I remember, sometimes I can't remember the happening, but it's like I remember the memory.
Right.
If that makes sense. And Nina Simone came down from Philadelphia to New York. It was a large club in Brooklyn, and she subbed for me. I don't know if it was one or two. I think it was just one night that I was unable to play. And Carmen McRae subbed for me one night. And after, when reading about Carmen McRae's life, she had already made some entrance into success and into
right.
Winning a recording date. But still, I know it's true that those two subbed for me.
What year was that?
That had to be, that must have been 56, because that's when I got my, I was there from 55 of May, and then it was somewhere between that and the end of 56, because then, you know, I was pregnant. So, so it was somewhere between 55 and 56, and I got my 801 musicians, my union card.
Right.
And another thing that happened during that time that was very exciting is that Harold photographed a number of covers, or did the artwork for covers, and he and I were in, there had to be two cars, I don't remember exactly, but Thelonious Monk and Thelonious and Gigi Grice, and I think one of them, who was the bass players of the Three, they were brothers.
Oh, Percy Heath?
Yeah. I do believe. I remember, you know, I was from the farm and gradually came to the city, but I remember going out on the highways, and I don't know who was driving, but I thought that was going to be the end of my life, because I think everybody except Harold was stoned out of their minds. And it was a frightening experience. But then I was there for the recording, which I don't remember very much about, and Harold didn't even take a photograph with me. Of me in that setting, or I doubt whether Monk would have wanted to take a photograph with me, but anyway. And one of the most exciting days in my life is when I went from Baltimore, when I had met Teddy Charles, but he didn't have anything. He just said, when you come to New York, here's my address, telephone number.
Right.
Was coming the last mile or so coming into New York City.
Yeah.
And where the bus just keeps curving around and around, and you see New York City in the distance, and finally ending up, you know, at whatever station it was. And going out and going on Broadway, I don't know what it did with my bags. I know I lived at the YWCA. And I walked down Broadway. I don't know, it must have been 40 blocks. I mean, it was just the most exciting, thrilling thing. And everybody in New York seemed so animated compared to my earlier life, and just the excitement of being in this city with, those 2 years, I just did so many things. When I look back and recreate in my mind all of the things I did in those 2 years, it's just, in other words, sometimes I think, my God, if my whole life had been that way, who knows what I could have become.
Right.
But then my family and my children are equally as important, and you can't have it both ways. So the only part I really regret is not knowing about birth control from 1960 to about 1964, the end of 1963. That's the only time I really, really regret. And I don't really see myself as wanting to be out in front of crowds of people like Diana Krall, Nina Simone. It's just the act of playing. Well, my last job that I had, I went from playing singles. Well, wait a minute. I played for 5 years at the Four Seasons Hotel in San Antonio, which is a pretty posh job.
Right.
And the Fairmont Hotel for about 5 years. And usually every job I had, I held for 5 years. And then there'd be a change of management and, you know, on to the next one. At the Four Seasons, I played with in a trio called the Dorian Mode, and taken from my name,
right,
and the scale, and that's why I worked with my husband and a percussion player. So I learned so much from that when I went to the Fairmont and I was playing a single, there was something missing, a bass and a drum, and percussion.
Right.
So I eventually developed a style where I was playing a left-hand bass and percussive kind of things. So that was a really good period of development. And then I got a job with Jim Cullum. Are you familiar with his name?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. So playing outdoors on the patio, he was indoors with his group, and I was outside, and I played with all the different horn players in San Antonio. And it was quite a switch to go from what I was doing to comping and, comping. It was a duo situation.
Right.
And I was playing with some of the best horn players in town. And he didn't pay very much, but just the learning, it was like being in private practice. And I wasn't really ready for it in the sense that I had never really learned how to play good intros or good endings very well. And I was not very well received by some of my fellow musicians. I was the only woman for those 12 years I was there that played outdoors, and then eventually, at the time I was there, I was the only woman.
Right.
And that's the first time I felt I experienced what I would call discrimination, or a man not wanting to play with me, because even though I wasn't really up to speed comping, I recorded myself and listened back to it, and so when my daughter became ill in New York in 95, I took a recording and had actually two lessons with Joanne Burkeen, who's one of my favorites. And I made the statement that, you know, the guys treat me pretty good. And she said, well, they should, because you're good.
Huh.
And that was, but this one particular player who I started out working with and worked with for a couple of years used to make derogatory remarks. He stood behind me and he insulted me. And if I turned around to answer him, he said, don't argue on the set. You know, you could, we can't argue in front, don't argue in front of an audience. And it was like picking myself up off the ground almost every night with him. And going home and woodshedding like crazy, you know, just working on my music. That was a very growthful period too. Some
right.
of, you know, what? What is the mother's invention? Mother of invention? I don't know if it has.
Right.
If I'm, okay, out of necessity. And out of wanting to learn more. And at that time, I wanted to play more of a bebop period. I had started to play things, a few of Monk's, and the one tune I liked. Anyway, I wanted to play the bebop tunes, and that's what I was working on.
Right.
And so that's where I was headed. And then this two musicians from New York came to town after I became sick. And they are like the royalty. We have some really fine musicians here. And one of them was Rich Oppenheim, and I played with him, and he was from Chicago, and he had a blues period where he played with all the great blues players, and he could play anything. And so that was one of the most exciting gigs of my life, and that's the direction I was heading in. That's what I wanted to do.
Yeah.
And somewhere in there, in a period of 10 years, I started playing a lot of fourths, like McCoy Tyner.
Right.
Kind of stuff, and I know I played good changes.
Yeah.
My changes were good. My harmonic structure was good. I wasn't developed as I wanted to be in my right hand improvisation.
Right.
But that got better and better. So that's the end of my story.
Okay. Well, that's great stuff, Dory. I think what I'll do is type up everything, including your emails, and send you a draft.
Uh-huh.
And let you look at it. Is that all right?
Yes. Yeah, thank you so much for listening to me, because, I mean, who else would want to hear an hour, whatever it is, of just listening to a person's life story.
Well, you've got great stuff to tell. I mean, there's a lot more, you know, that I'd like to ask you about, but I think that, I've got about 5 pages of notes here, single spaced. One of the things you said that I underlined is you said, I don't remember it happening, but I remember the memory.
Things happen, and it's so outstanding, so you tell somebody else about it, and it becomes more and more dim in your memory, but you know it happened. I mean, I remember sending a 20, I think it was a $20 check, it could have been 25, to Nina Simone in Philadelphia.
Right.
That's obviously what I was earning per night at that time.
Right.
I don't know if you I not identify, but what's the word? Resonate with the concept of that of.
Yeah, I think it makes a lot of sense. I think especially the way you just flushed it out by saying something is so outstanding, you talk about it, but the actual event gets more dim.
Yeah, but it's like a memory of a memory of something happened.
Yeah, the memory becomes bigger than the actual event. I think that's fascinating. What the other thing when
Write a book. I started to write a bio of my life, and when my daughter became very sick and she was diagnosed in '95, I dropped it. And then since I've been encouraged by several people to write a bio, but I don't want. I'm 76. And I don't want to commit myself to one thing,
Right.
you know, to feel that I have to do this. I just want a free-floating life.
Right.
And that's where I am. And yeah, I think that would be great if you, whenever you can put that into a draft. And I'm going to be sending anything, any drafts or anything by email because working, I know how to work pages, but all this cutting and pasting just interrupts my flow of thought.
Right.
And so I'll be sending anything just by email.
Okay.
But
Great.
what I was thinking when I received the draft, if there's anything that I think that really fits or that I feel excited about, I would interject, you
Okay,
know,
that sounds great.
or make a copy and then add it to that part of your narrative.
That sounds great, Dory. Let's do that.
Okay.
All right.
Thanks.
Well, thank you so much for your time and your willingness to share these stories with me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, and I mean the biggest thing is, are you familiar with Nicholas Kristof
Oh, sure.
and his wife Cheryl? I know her name. What he's doing for maternal health care in the world.
Oh, I know. I heard him on the radio one day. I was out in New Mexico, and he was on local public radio out there,
Local, huh?
and I heard he was talking about that topic,
Yeah.
and one of the things he said is that journalism does not cover well. He said this. This is what he said: journalism covers well what happens one day. Journalism does not cover well what happens every day. And
Every day, and I also thought that included the idea of seeing, being a visionary.
right.
projecting into the future. I saw him and his wife on the book channel on Saturday and Sundays.
C-SPAN.
The book sample is C-SPAN, too.
Yeah.
All books, and that's where I first saw him. And to think of the 50 years that Margaret Sanger devoted her life to, and we're still at this point of the opposition to, I believe, in giving free birth control, access to free birth control to all the women of the world, especially, well, those who are in underdeveloped countries who are living lives that are so miserable that, as my friend said, they're igniting themselves, they're killing themselves.
Right.
So that's, Margaret Sanger was born into a family of 11, and so that gave her a good lead in. Well, you'll have to finish the sentence. It gave her, it started her perspective of what it was like to be poor, and the more kids you had, the less you had. And then living close enough to neighborhoods of plenty, which she sometimes visited, where she saw how that things were available, and education was available, and nurturance and taking care of the child was available when you had less children.
Yeah.
So thank you, Sam.
Thank you, Dory. I'm gonna type all this up and send it to you when I'm done, and then we'll move from there.
Okay, great.
Have a good weekend.
You as well.
Take care.